Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez has not been seen or heard from since undergoing a fourth operation for cancer in Cuba shortly after winning re-election to a fourth term. He missed his own presidential inauguration on January 10th, leading to concern and speculation over his health and longevity, and also about the future of Venezuela. Chavez has led Venezuela since 1999 and is known for his radical social and economic programs and for openly calling his political ideology socialism of the 21st century. Chavez has taken on poverty, food sovereignty, health access, and education. One of his biggest economic moves was centralizing Venezuela's oil resources under state control. Venezuela has the largest natural gas reserves in Latin America and the largest deposit of oil in the world. But Venezuela is also polarized between Chavez supporters and the opposition parties, who, like one of today's guests, points out that the country's debt has quintupled in the last 14 years. Many are also calling him a dictator, changing the constitution to allow him to serve unlimited terms and shutting down media outlets critical of his policies. Now, with Chavez's health in question, the country's future and the future of Latin America also hangs in the balance. So, to discuss the Chavez legacy and the future of Venezuela, we are joined by Miguel Tinker Salas, who's a professor of Latin American history and Chicano-Latino studies at Pomona College. He's the author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela. And his most recent book, which is soon to be published, is Venezuela, Everything You Need to Know. Welcome, Miguel.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by Francisco Toro, who's a Venezuelan journalist, political scientist, and a blogger. Since 2002, he's run Caracas Chronicles. That's an English language blog on all things Venezuelan. He joins us from Montreal. Hi, Francisco.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for being with us. And we've also got Sujatha Fernandez, who is an associate professor of sociology at Queens College and the Graduate Center at CUNY, City University of New York. She is the author of Who Can Stop the Drums? Urban Social Movements in Chavez's Venezuela. Hi.
Hi, Holly. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. All right. Well, we've got a lot to discuss, and it might be nice to get some background on Venezuela for our listeners. But I'm going to actually start with President Chavez's battle with cancer, which has prevented him from assuming his presidential responsibilities. Who can somebody just give us a little background of who's in control right now? Why has Chavez's health status been so guarded by the administration? And why is he being treated in Cuba? Who wants to take that?
I'll be glad to take it. Fundamentally, he had cancer. He announced to the country he had cancer in 2011. He is undergoing, as you pointed out, several efforts at surgery and chemotherapy. The current government is being run by Nicolás Maduro, the vice president, who was formerly the Minister of Foreign Relations. And the issue of the constitutional relationship in terms of his swearing in was in many ways resolved by some, for some people's perspective, by the Supreme Court, who said that he could be sworn in at a different time. And again, much of it is guarded because of the very nature of politics in Venezuela. I personally would prefer a lot more openness and a lot more transparency, but the reality of Venezuelan politics is that his health has become a state secret, and he's being treated in Cuba because his team believes that they have closed relationship where he can protect information about his health and has high quality doctors, which include Cuba's best, we would presume.
And Venezuela has also imported a lot of Cuban doctors, tens of thousands of them, into Venezuela.
It's part of a program called Barrio Adentro, in which the government has received over 15,000 Cuban doctors to provide medical services in neighborhoods that previously did not receive them. And at the same time, Cuba has received oil credits at long-term prices for its needed economy.
And part of Chavez's power stems from his enormous charisma and his ability to connect with large majorities of Venezuelans. Is there a lot of fear within the Chavista parties of what will happen post-Chavez if he doesn't recover from this cancer?
Well, I think that there's a whole question of Chavismo without Chavez, and that in some ways was answered during the election for governors in December when the PSUV, the party that Chavez helped found, the Socialist Party of Venezuela, actually won 20 of 23 governorships without Chavez actually campaigning. And with now those governors in office, you have a very formidable political machine that the PSUV controls for any future election. So there are signs that Chavismo can survive without Chavez, but obviously Nicolás Maduro, the current vice president, is not a figure that can be, that resembles Chavez either in terms of charisma, his connection to the population, or any of his other attributes that Chavez has.
And I know that people feel really passionate about Chavez, both for and against. I'm wondering what you all agree on. One of the things that I read about Venezuela was that it was in a deep economic and social decline in the 90s prior to Chavez taking office. Can somebody give us a little bit of the political, social, and economic background immediately preceding Chavez's rise to power?
Well, I can do that.
Well, this is Francisco.
Venezuela had been in long-term decline for easily 20 years ahead of Chavez's coming to office, and there was this deep thirst for reform. Chavez tapped into something very powerful there, this frustration that living standards had been declining. But from my point of view, and I think Professor Tinker Salas would agree with this, this has to do with oil. Venezuela is a remarkably oil-dependent country, and oil prices had not kept up with the demands of the population for a long time.
Well, if you look, in fact, oil prices when Chavez comes to power are running between $7 and $8 a barrel. The country didn't have enough resources to actually, and it was actually being mismanaged. I mean, there was tremendous crises. Institutions were failing. Political parties had lost all prestige. Crime was on the increase. Inflation was skyrocketing. The political parties had lost all faith. People had lost all faith in the political parties. It was a very dire consequence, particularly coming on the heels of the fact that in 1989, there had been massive social upheavals in the form of protest against what at that time were efforts to impose austerity package.
And so this is the climate within which Chavez is elected. Tell us about the early years of Chavismo.
Who is being directed to?
Who would like to? How about a little bit of both? Or maybe we can bring Sujatha into this.
To talk about the early years of...
Yeah, I know that you've studied the social movements, but what was happening in 1999?
Soon after Chavez came to power, he wanted to completely rewrite the Constitution, and that was a process that really involved a lot of different groups, from indigenous movements to women's movements, and brought in what was going to be the sort of participatory element of his government, while at the same time, sort of at that point in the late 90s, reassuring investors and other people that he wasn't going to diverge too far from the sort of structural adjustment policies followed by earlier governments. And I think it was more, it becomes closer into about the middle of the 2000s when he really started moving along the path to socialism and his socialist program.
And how was that received? Go ahead, Francisco.
Well, I think it's important to note that there was huge polarization from quite early on. From 1999 to 2000, you started to get this superheated political rhetoric from both sides, and a lot of strife and building into these mass social protests in 2001 and into 2002. Then an era of kind of complete craziness between 2002 and 2005, when you had an attempted coup that went very badly wrong. You had a two-month strike of the National Oil Company. You had votes. You had sort of daily marches with hundreds of thousands of people on the street for on one side over the other. And what's clear is that Chavez profited hugely from that polarization, because polarization always worked to his advantage. Polarization allowed him to paint his opponents, people like me, in disguise of being sort of extremists and wreckers and oligarchic rump. And we sort of walked right into that trap again and again for a 3 to 4 year period there. And at the end of that, what we ended up was from having a state where control was contested between the government and the opposition to a state that by 2005, 2006, 2007 is becoming more and more monolithically controlled by one person. So he was elected. He was clearly very, very popular, and he kept winning elections. But what he did with the power that he received at elections was to consolidate a kind of authoritarian control over the state and more and more over society.
Can you go a little deeper? Go ahead, Miguel Tinger Salas.
Well, I think it's important.
As you talk about that, can you go a little deeper into what happened with the 2002-2003 oil strike and how that affected the economy?
Sure. I think it's important to point out that polarization was in many ways fed by the opposition. They still viewed Chavez as an aberration. I mean, it speaks to the control that a political elite in Venezuela, both parties, Acción Democrática and COPEI, and their other followers, had over the national apparatus, over the political structure, over the cultural, and over the national narrative. So in many ways, they saw Chavez as an aberration. They couldn't understand how Venezuela, this exceptional democracy that since 1958 had peacefully had transfer of power, yes, it had some social problems. Yes, it had a guerrilla movement during the 1960s and 70s. And yes, there were different issues of equality and poverty was increasing. But they saw Chavez as an aberration because in many ways they couldn't really reflect on the fact that the model was actually not working for the majority of Venezuelans. And I think that, therefore, they really reacted in very undemocratic fashions. Not only did the coup go wrong, but a coup either by Chavez or the opposition is simply wrong. It really did throw the country into a greater turmoil, increase the polarization. And then by 2002, when the coup failed, the first coup in Latin America to have been reverted by the population and by the military itself, putting Chavez back into power, then the effort became essentially to shut down the oil company. And a national strike, or some people call it a lockout, again, even that's a polarizing issue, that actually brought the economy to its knees. So when we talk about the economy being in trouble, yes, because of a national strike over oil production, where oil production went from 3 million barrels a day down to 50, 60, 70,000 barrels a day, where Venezuela had to import oil. And through all that period, Chavez actually did weather the storm and increase support. But that's the context for the polarization. And then the notion that somehow Chavez invented polarization, I think, is also part of this argument that says that nothing happened, that these crises and these conditions didn't exist before he came to power.
And Francisco, maybe you can respond to that. Do you think that the opposition misread Chavez and miscalculated in terms of how the opposition acted within the country, within the political structure?
Tactically, I think they clearly did misread the situation. They fed this polarization narrative that, you know, it's good that your listeners are getting a bit of a feel here for the kinds of debates that Venezuelans have been having very passionately for the last 14 years, because people like Professor Tinger Salas and I can probably argue about this all day and all night. It's clear to me that there is no polarization unless you have two sides escalating. And it's very clear that the opposition participated gleefully and wrongheadedly in this polarization strategy from 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005. It's also true on a longer-term basis that the reason that the opposition saw Chavez as an aberration was that Chavez was clearly interested in consolidating an amount of power and a direct personal control over every aspect of the Venezuelan state. We're talking about the courts, we're talking about the army, we're talking about which has become a Praetorian Guard, we're talking about every aspect of the Venezuelan state was being turned into a personal agency that was following orders from the President of the Republic. And we know that's true because in the last few years, we've had not one but two members of the Venezuelan Supreme Tribunal who have defected and who have spoken in detail about the ways that they personally followed orders, personal orders, Chavez's personal orders to put particular political opponents in jail. Even judges who failed to rule the way the government intended for them to rule have found themselves in jail. So it's also not true that the opposition just sort of made up this idea that there was an authoritarian intent or an authoritarian project hiding behind the radical egalitarian discourse. I think the evidence points very clearly to that.
Francisco Toro is a Venezuelan journalist, political scientist, and blogger. Since 2002, he's run Caracas Chronicles, an English-language blog on all things Venezuelan. We'll put a link to all of this information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We're talking about Venezuela and the legacy of Hugo Chavez and the future of Venezuela. We're also joined by Miguel Tinker Salas, who's a professor of Latin American history at Pomona College. He's the author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, culture, and citizenship in Venezuela, and his most recent book is about to be published. It's Venezuela, Everything You Need to Know. We're also joined by Sujatha Fernandez, who's an associate professor of sociology at Queens College and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. She's the author of Who Can Stop the Drums? Urban Social Movements in Chavez's Venezuela. I'll invite callers to join us in just a minute. But you brought up the treatment of the opposition, Francisco. I'm wondering what your read is, Miguel, on political crackdowns, jailing of opposition figures, closing radio stations that were critical of the Chavez regime. How is the opposition treated in Venezuela?
I think the image one has if one reads the newspapers abroad is that the opposition is under a barrage of attacks and that they are hiding in different places in Venezuela. The reality is quite the opposite. You have an active opposition press. In fact, most of the mainstream press, both digital, print, and media television, is controlled largely by the opposition. The numbers of opposition press are 70-80%. I mean, the government has a few public television channels. What they object to the most is when Chavez has a national press conference called the Cadena in Venezuela and interrupts a series of programs. The opposition has access, has parties, it has a presence in the National Assembly. I think that we also need to talk about their mistakes again, because in 2005, for example, they decided to boycott an election and giving Chavez 100% control of the National Assembly. So again, those are the mistakes that they make. Yes, there are a few people that were arrested that are in jail. They were actually police commanders that were involved in the 2002 coup, in which there were shootings of civilians, half of which were Chavistas, half of which were opposition. But again, they were responsible for the military. And yes, the judge, Afini, is in jail after having come from a trip to Miami, and she personally freed a person who was involved in a corruption scandal. I would prefer a lot more transparency on all these matters and all these issues. But I don't want your listeners to get the impression that somehow the opposition is isolated by is being cracked down. There is a lot of discussion in Venezuela, and the fact that you can pick up any paper, El Universal, El Nacional, you can go to Globovisión, you can go to any of the major Tal Cual, Los Reportes de Miguel, all of them, you can see the opposition is active, alive, participates in the National Assembly, and there's an active discourse in which the government is constantly criticized, so that this is not a society in which there's only one voice, but there are many, many voices, and there's criticisms of Chavez from the left as well that are part of this discourse.
Well, let me bring Sujatha into this conversation. You've studied the urban social movements under Chavez. What movements were created or strengthened under Chavez? Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Well, I think there were a range of movements that have been strengthened over the course of the last decade, and in particular, the ones that I've been interested in have been cultural movements and movements of community-based media, mural movements. You can really see the way in which the black and mestizo urban majority have felt empowered by Chavez being in government, and have and this is partly they take inspiration from his speeches. They draw into long existing movements. So the community media movement didn't just spring up suddenly when Chavez appeared, but had existed much before it. And through Chavez and his ability and you know, his promotion of policies to legalize community media, low power radio and televisions, they gained much more visibility and legitimacy within society. And so, you know, I really think that the urban space of this of Caracas and of the cities in Venezuela has changed as a result of the last, you know, 10, 15 years, because of the legitimacy given to people talking about being mestizo, being indigenous, being poor and urban and being in the majority and not being excluded anymore. And this is one of Chavez's very strong and powerful you know, rhetoric and symbol that he has constantly used, is of bringing the excluded out from the margins and into the majority and into visibility. And culture has been such a huge part of that, and I think that's been a success. You walk around in one of the barrios and you can see in one of the very long-standing barrios called 23 Enero, on one of the walls, there is huge murals of indigenous chiefs that has been done by one of the residents there, who just said he felt inspired because Chavez told people to know their roots. And, you know, and you can see during the June and July time, which is when a lot of the fiestas happen, in all of the barrios, people are celebrating the Cruz de Mayo festival. They're celebrating San Juan, which is not something that happened before Chavez came into office, because it wasn't really encouraged. In fact, it was looked down upon. And Chavez is given funding and cultural institutions have promoted these kind of fiestas, and so there's this really joyous kind of time when people are in the streets and they're celebrating, and it's not necessarily, I mean, the opposition will say, well, these are just all propaganda attempts of the government to, you know, clientelism, to buy off people in the barrios. And I would say from my observations from the time that I've spent there, of course that element is there, and people understand the fact they're getting money from the government. How is this going to influence what they can do? That concern is there. But there is also this kind of hope and pride that you see in people in their identity and in their, you know, this new sense of hope that they've had.
And one of the things that I read about also is that one of the biggest complaints that people in Caracas have is of the rising violence and crime. It has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. I think in a city of 3 million, an estimated 3,600 people were murdered, which adds up to about one every 2 hours. What do you read of the increase in violence?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that, following on from the factors that the others have talked about, from the debt crisis, from the period of the 90s, this problem in crime goes back, you know, to the spiraling poverty of the decade of the 90s, to the increasing gang activity, the increasing crime, and it's something that the Chavez government has tried to tackle, has had some improvements in some places and not in other places, but is a very real problem, particularly for people who live in the urban barrios and who face this on a daily basis. And, you know, and from my perspective, working with community movements, I saw, for instance, people who work in the popular fiestas, the religious fiestas, trying to use that as a way to draw young people away from gangs and away from crime and into positive kind of activities that they can do. And so this is one of the ways that I saw, you know, the government sort of trying to work with these community-based organizations to try and reduce this problem. And, you know, and it's such a battle. At one of these fiestas, the son of the organizer was shot by a gang member. And it's even people who are really trying to do something find themselves this intractable problem that has developed over several decades and is not going to go away very easily.
And let me invite listeners to join our conversation on your column, Holly Kernan. And if you're a Venezuelan or from somewhere else in Latin America, what do you think of Hugo Chavez and what he's done in Venezuela and in Latin America? Has it had a larger effect in other countries? Our number is 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Talk. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Do you think you're getting an accurate picture of the situation from U.S. media? And what do you want to know about how Venezuela has changed in the past 14 years under Chavez? The number again is 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do you think is the lasting impact of Chavismo in Latin America? And what do you hope will be the legacy of Chavez's reforms in Latin America? Again, it's 866-798-8255. We'll put links to all of the information from our guests at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Miguel Tinker Salas, who's a professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College. He is the author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela. And his most recent book, soon to be published, is Venezuela, Everything You Need to Know. We're also joined by Francisco Toro, who is a Venezuelan journalist, political scientist, and blogger. And since 2002, he's run Caracas Chronicles, which is an English-language blog on all things Venezuelan. Again, we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. He's been covering Venezuela as a freelance foreign correspondent since 1999 to 2003. He reported for The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The Financial Times. We're also joined by Sujatha Fernandez, who's an associate professor of sociology at Queens College and the Graduate Center. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after a short break.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that depends on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-798 Talk. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can also sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page, yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, how do children and teens benefit from mentoring? If you've been a mentor, how did it change you? Friday is our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And today we're talking about what's next for Venezuela. We're having a conversation about the political situation in Venezuela. President Hugo Chavez's battle with cancer has prevented him from assuming his presidential responsibilities. He's currently hospitalized in Cuba, and many think he may not survive. So how has Venezuela changed since Chavez took power 14 years ago? And how has Chavez's revolution changed the socio-political landscape in Latin America? If you want to join our conversation, there's one open line, not anymore, sorry, 866-798-TALK. There will be open line soon, and I'll give out the number again then. I wanted to, before we go to calls, we've got a lot of calls and I want to get to them, but one quick question for you, Sujatha, is what do you think Chavez's economic changes mean concretely for, say, this is just an example, a single mother of three who does laundry to make a living or who works in a factory? Like, what has this economic and social political changes meant in her life and in the life of her kids?
Well, I think that they've meant a lot of things. They've meant through different programs like soup kitchens, it means that her kids can, you know, get a meal in the local neighborhood soup kitchen. Through the Mercal, which is a grocery store, it means that she can get subsidized products that otherwise she might not have had available or might not have been able to afford at the local grocery store. And also, I think that, as Miguel had mentioned earlier, the Cuban doctors have made a tremendous difference in the lives of people where high up in the far reaches of the shanty towns, people who had no medical attention and would have to take, you know, a long time to be able to make it down to a hospital if they were sick, who actually have doctors there who can attend to them. Now, I'm not saying that it's this kind of rosy picture where suddenly, you know, there are huge changes, because there are problems. There is corruption. There are corruption in quite a few of these programs that I've seen and heard about. And there are other problems too, but I think that overall people have found a lot of changes in their lives as a result of these programs, and to the extent that even the opposition was saying during the recent election campaign that if they came into power, they would continue with the missions. That's the level of popularity that they have among people.
And I wanted to ask both Miguel and Francisco. So, Miguel, you're a supporter of Chavez. Francisco, you're in the opposition. I want to ask each of you. I want to ask you, Francisco, what do you think are the greatest achievements of Chavez? And, Miguel, what do you consider the most problematic aspects of his leadership? Why don't we start with you, Francisco?
Well, I mean, I think as Sujata got at it quite well in saying that it's been a kind of massive therapy session for people who had been marginalized for a long time in Venezuela. I think people who were symbolically left out of mainstream Venezuelan society for many, many years love him, and love him for good reason, because he makes them feel good about themselves, and that is worth something. I don't think it's worth destroying the country's democratic institutions, but it's worth something.
And so same question to you, Miguel. What do you consider the most problematic aspects of Chavez?
First of all, I'd retake the issue of a supporter of Chavez. I have strong criticisms of the government as well. But on the other hand, I think that one of the main problems is the question of hyper leadership. So much focus on Chavez really draws attention away from what Suyapa has been describing, which is the real protagonist role of the social movements in Venezuela, and the fact that they have been really empowered and transformative in this entire process. But the other issue is the political culture of corruption, of bureaucracy that continues to impede much of this this process, so that there's a rhetoric and a discourse of change, and then on the ground you have all sorts of problems, from bottlenecks in food distribution to corruption to bureaucratization to a lot of the old political cultural factors that are still present. And I think that that's really going to hurt this process long term more than anything else.
And let's go to our callers. Let's start with Malena in San Francisco. Welcome to your call. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the show, and thank you for having me on. I wanted to talk about my experience having been in Venezuela a number of times over the last 13 years, and I had a couple of points to make. The first one is about the media and the manipulation of the information by the opposition media. In particular, I remember around the time of the coup, the attempted coup, soon afterwards, Chavez had said on one of his long discourses that the Supreme Court should obey the Constitution. That seems pretty sensible, right? The Supreme Court needs to obey the law, the Constitution. While the media then later represented his speech as him saying that the Supreme Court should be disobeyed and therefore that he was a dictator. So this is just an example of how the information was so manipulated by the opposition media. And I wanted to also say about the media, soon afterwards there was a law of ley de medios, which is a law governing what the media could and couldn't do. And this was also manipulated to distort it, to say that there was a lot of repression of freedom of speech. But really, if you look at what it says, it's democratizing the media. It's giving more access to people in communities to have a voice, as well as really cutting down on those who were abusing their power in the media, such as calling for the assassination of the president on the air, which anywhere else would be completely illegal. So that's really my major point. And the second one is about democracy and what does it mean. And I want to point out how some of your guests have mentioned that with this government, there has been more popular participation, and how important that is in a true democracy, as well as true representation and public interest. So that's a big point. And I do have the concern of this government being having more posts, important posts, being occupied by men in the military. So this is a concern I do have about this government.
And thank you for that, Malena. Let's go first to Sujatha, because I know you have to leave us soon.
Yes. I absolutely agree with those points about the media, and I just want to make the additional point that with the democratization of the media, one of the very important things that has happened has been, as I discussed earlier, the creation of community media stations, because many of the community media stations say, look, we can't get our point across in the private media or in the government-run media. The kind of things we want to talk about are just, you know, there's no space. And I'll give you the example of a journalist called Madera, a black journalist, who has a show that he says is for black men and women on his station, Radio Negro Primero. Now, that kind of show has not been done either on the government media or on the private media. And so one of the things that I witnessed in Venezuela was the opening up of spaces at the very local level, even out, not in the government programs, not in the private programs, but on the level of the community, which I thought was very important.
Sujatha Fernandez is an associate professor of sociology at Queens College and the Graduate Center at City University of New York. She's the author of Who Can Stop the Drums? Urban Social Movements in Chavez's Venezuela. We'll put a link to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. I know you have to go, Sujatha. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, honey.
We really appreciate it. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're speaking about the current political situation in Venezuela and the legacy, the political, social, and economic legacy of Hugo Chavez in both Venezuela and Latin America. Let's go to Antulio in Canada. Hi, Antulio.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Thank you for having me.
Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Yes. No, I just have a couple of comments about the show. It's a very good show. However, I think it reflects the very much polarized nature of discussion that goes on about Venezuela and within Venezuela. And one of the major issues that are not discussed is what kind of problems do citizens face when having this kind of polarization. And one thing is that, for example, the media is very well framed around these two polls, either in favor or against Hugo Chavez, and various issues are completely neglected. For example, we can see that in Latin America there are various legislative moves towards legalizing gay marriage or to discussing about abortion rights or reproductive rights for women or other gender issues. These are completely neglected in the Venezuelan public space, and it's due to the impoverished discussion that there is in public opinion due to the polarization levels that are so extreme. And other people, the most romantic comments about the Bolivarian Revolution refer to the heightened levels of participation, which is true to a certain extent. There is a lot of participation in local experiments with regards to communal solutions, but that participation has a ceiling. There is a complete ceiling to what extent that participation can last and what kind of decisions it can make. And so, for example, hindering democratic institutions, as Francisco is pointing at, is another example that in which there is less diversity ever more within representative institutions. There is less capacity to voice out these other hindered topics and issues that are not part of the agenda in the polarized context. And this is very problematic, and no local participation can reach that level. There is no discussion about environmental issues and about oil exploitation and about other topics that are not part or captured by this language of polarization. And
Antulio, stay on the line for a second. Miguel has written a lot about this. He says polarization is a reality of Venezuelan politics, and it has deep roots in Venezuelan society. Can you just talk a little bit to that and to Antulio's points?
I think Antulio made some very, very good points. I mean, I think, unfortunately, given the level of polarization, we are not having a conversation on a broad range of issues, not only in terms of gender, but in terms of sexuality, but also in terms of the environment and in terms of race. And in fact, when the government sponsored constitution reform in 2007 included some of those issues, they were actually not approved by a small margin, less than 1%, but nonetheless weren't approved. I prefer personally would love to have a much broader conversation about the very issues he's mentioned, and particularly about race, because this is something that, although we see the rights of people being guaranteed in the Constitution and the rights of indigenous as the first settlers of Venezuela, for example, the issue of Afro-descendants does not receive the same sort of attention. And unfortunately, the polarization and the discourse on both sides, on the part of the opposition and the government, tends to obscure a much broader conversation on these issues. But I also do think that to talk about the fact that polarization is only occurring in the context of a Chavez era fails to recognize the deep cleavages in society going back to the independence period, in which race and class have been a constant accompaniment of Venezuelan society. And what happened during the 1960s was that we created a mythology about Venezuela. Somehow Venezuela was different than the rest of Latin America. It had resolved fundamental political transfer of power, of race issues, of class, but they were all there. They were under the surface, and they were felt by the people of color who weren't recognized in society. And you know, the notion that Venezuela was a mixture of café con leche, coffee and milk, coined by Andrés Eloy Blanco, actually served to obscure the fact that racial divisions and racial prejudice continued in Venezuela. In fact, Andrés Eloy Blanco has to write a beautiful poem, Píntame Angelitos Negros. Please paint some black angels, because all we see is the white virgin surrounded by white angels and never see a black persona in the context of a Venezuelan identity.
That's Miguel Tink. Go ahead, Francisco.
Well, I just wanted to say that I also agree with much that Antulio had to say, but I think it's important to understand that polarization, while it is rooted in deep cleavages in Venezuelan society, is not only that. It's also a political tactic. It's also a political tactic that's used quite cynically by the government to divide and conquer.
Quite effectively as well.
This is something that they've done very, very, very successfully. I mean, as a kind of, thinking as a political strategist, I have to take my hat off to them, because they've done it brilliantly. I mean, they've put us into a corner through this polarization strategy. But I also want to mention one other thing, because Antulio mentioned the environment, and I think it's very important. On February 4th of last year, there was a major oil spill in the eastern Venezuelan city of Maturin, near it. It contaminated the river through which most of the drinking water for the city comes to. This oil spill was caused because the workers for the local chapter of the Venezuelan oil industry were not there. And why were they not there? Because they had been bused to Caracas. And why were they bused to Caracas? Because it was the anniversary of the 20th anniversary of Chavez's coup attempt against the previous democratically elected government.
The 1992 coup attempt.
That's right. And so they were not there. So when the oil pipeline burst, there was nobody there to stop it. Okay? When Venezuelan, when independent media tried to report on this story, they were stopped through an injunction and told that any such type of reporting had to be done on the basis of lab reports on drinking water's quality approved by the government. So you see the way that the government can use its power, okay, to condition the kinds of things that are sayable and that are not sayable in the Venezuelan public sphere. And I want to go back just slightly to what has been said about the media, because I really feel that the discussion here is anachronistic. It's true that the Venezuelan private sector had a strong media presence up until 2003, 2004. But the way it's been described in this program is badly, badly out of date. What we have today is a situation with a single TV broadcaster that is free to air and critical of the government, and they're only free to air in two cities. A situation where more than 30 radio stations have been shut down purely because they don't agree with the government, a situation where there is massive self-censorship in the private media because people know that you can be shut down for criticizing the government, and at the same time a huge growth of state broadcasting through, I think it's now 7 nationwide TV stations, many of the community radio stations that Sujata was talking about, which some of them are independent, many of them are effectively government spokespieces. There is a policy in place for media hegemony. And this is an openly discussed aim of the Bolivarian government, is to establish hegemony over what Venezuelans can know. Okay? Now, it is true that there are spaces online and on print media, but the reality is that most people don't read their news to them. So most people listen to their news on TV and on the radio. And it's getting much more difficult now to get alternative points of view.
Francisco Toro. Guys, hold on one sec. Francisco Toro is a Venezuelan journalist, and he runs Caracas Chronicles. He's speaking with Miguel Tinker Salas, who's a professor of Latin American history at Pomona College. We're talking about Venezuela and the polarization that exists there. So Francisco was just talking about the media landscape. Miguel, if you could be brief, I want to get to more calls.
I'll be brief. I will just invite your listeners to go to the Venezuelan media sites, see it for themselves, and if they can see that the fact that the opposition has a voice in just about everything in the national discourse. Let me just add that polarization is used by both sides to close ranks, and the opposition does it as well and has their own myths and their own notions and their own conceptions of what Venezuelan society looks like, but they use it for the same purpose.
And any links that you send us we'll put at yourcallradio.org so folks can check it out for themselves. We have a comment from Alex who writes, I must add that in Venezuela, media manipulation comes from both sides. We have a few more minutes. I'm going to get out our number one more time. We're talking about Venezuela, its recent past, and the legacy of Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian Revolution. How has Chavez changed the socio-political landscape in both Venezuela and Latin America? The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you are from Venezuela or Latin America, we'd be very interested to hear your take on Chavez's influence, both positive, negative, and nuanced. 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. And let's go to Antonio in San Leandro. Welcome to your call.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. First, I want to say that this socialism on the 21st century in Venezuela is a total fraud. Chavez makes nice anti-imperialist speeches, but actually he sells his oil mostly to the United States. He also made the National Workers Union, made it a branch of the Chavista Party. And the opposition unionists that actually tried to build a opposition union were killed. Four of them were killed in the state of Aragua in a single action, and another four were killed in front of the Mitsubishi plant in Venezuela when they were on strike by the police. At Toyota, there were also union stewards, opposition union stewards who were killed. Dozens of them have been killed. He also presided over the handing over of FARC leaders to the Colombian government, like Joaquin Pérez Becerra, who was a journalist, and he was exiled in Sweden for 20 years. And he came to Venezuela thinking that he was safe there. And he was deported.
Okay, Antonio, I'm going to ask you to hold on for a sec. Let's get a response from Francisco and Miguel.
Well, you know, I think one clear dividing line between people who support the government and people who don't is that people who support the government try to look more at a grassroots level social organizations. And people who, like me, on the opposing side, tend to look more at the great institutions of state, like you know, the National Assembly, the courts, the army. So these kinds of large institutions. And so I think this is why we tend to have conversations that quite often kind of we quite often tend to talk past each other, is that we're not actually talking about the same things. What I do notice is that Teresa's tend not to want to talk about what's happened to the great institutions of state, because what's happened to the great institutions of state is that a government that was elected and that is popular has used its power and its popularity to completely drive out other points of view and to monopolize all state power in a single person.
Can I ask you a question, Francisco, about that? Was it possible to do that because those great state institutions weren't representing great parts of the population?
Well, I mean, the Constitution was changed, and everyone was appointed anew by the new authorities. So
the Constitution was changed by an electoral vote of the people of Venezuela, and they was approved in a mega election in 2000. So that there is a process here that is democratic. There's been 17 national elections here.
There's a process that is clearly very popular. I don't think anybody would dispute that. Now, for me, it's deeply disquieting that what this popularity has allowed the government to do has been to essentially to consolidate autocratic control under a single person of the state. We have so much evidence of this on so many levels, in so many institutions. We have so many testimonies, and it's open for anyone to see. So, you know, in the end, I think what we're looking at with Chavez is something like an elected autocrat, is someone who you cannot call a dictator, and I would never call a dictator, because most Venezuelans clearly agree with him and clearly support his vision of the state. But that vision of the state is authoritarian, where a single person makes all the key decisions.
So let me ask both of you, we're running out of time here, and I'll get you in here, Miguel, but it seems like everybody is saying that the next few years in Venezuela are likely to be turbulent. I'm wondering what each of you thinks that the transition from Chavez to new leadership, how that'll affect the country and how that'll work.
I want to touch what you said. I think that what you pointed out earlier, Holly, was that these institutions, in fact, were very weak in Venezuela. They were dominated by a political structure. They had become ineffective. They didn't represent the population. So much of this has been driven by that change and much of that kind of polarization we talk about. But let me underscore that polarization is part of what we're living now in this post-Cold War era. We're seeing it in the U.S. We're seeing it in Mexico. We're seeing it in every major political environment. So I don't think Venezuela is very unique in that sense. In fact, it continues to pursue much of the same. We see the same political landscape developing in many countries in Latin America. But I think we have entered a post-Chavez era. I think we're looking at the possibility of Chavismo without Chavez. I don't think that we're necessarily looking at a very difficult transition period. If Chavez does not return soon, there will have to be elections. And again, those elections will increase the polarization as both sides attempt to win over their adherents and their support. But I think that that's part of the political process we've seen evolving. I don't think Venezuela's on the edge of the precipice. I don't think that I'm not a proponent of the school of chaos that the country's falling apart. I think that Venezuelans continue to exercise their daily life. It's in that context that these changes have taken place. And I think that's the context for change in Venezuela. But change in all of Latin America as well, because the implications and the impact of Venezuela has been much beyond its borders. And it's been really the integration of Venezuela back into Latin America.
And Francisco, I want to get a final thought from you, but let me read an email from Emiliana. I'm a Venezuelan living in Caracas, and I can say that I have been convinced by actually living here rather than opining from a distance that the monstrous violence to which all sectors of society are subjected is actually being pursued as state policy. I believe the government is behooved by chaos, thrives on poverty, and needs lawlessness in order to justify its ever-growing size. The more chaos and violence present in our daily lives, the more tolerant all Venezuelans become toward government intervention. She goes on to write, as for the Chavez legacy, yes, he included many sectors of society that were up to now ignored, but this has been done to the detriment of our institutions, our values, and our economy in the long term. It's a longer email. We can post it at our website. Let me get final thoughts from you, Francisco.
Well, I just say that as transition goes forward, one thing that's been very noticeable about the Chavez years is that although you've had this huge concentration of power in the office of the presidency and this very extreme and very violent discourse against the opposition, you really haven't had that much repression. This is not a country where we have gulags. This is not a country where dissidents stay up at night waiting anxiously for a knock on the door. And why haven't we had that much repression? Why haven't we had that much violence from a government that controls so much power? It's because Chavez had three things. He had money, a lot of oil money. He had personal charisma, and he had authority over his own followers and his own movement. Now, with Chavez in his deathbed and probably out of the scene in the next few weeks or months, what we're going to see is him replaced by seconds in command who don't have that. Maduro or Diosdado Cabello, who's the other possible successor, neither of them have the charisma that Chavez had. The economy is not what it was, and public spending is under a bit of an austerity drive at the moment, and neither of them have the personal prestige to impose their will on the Chavista movement. And so when the three aspects that have kept this authoritarian state from being very violently repressive are taken away, I think that what this leaves you is in front of the very clear possibility of the Venezuelan state post-Chavez being much more repressive.
Francisco, we're going to have to leave it there. I wish we had more time to speak with both of you. Francisco Toro is a freelance journalist and political blogger for Caracas Chronicles. We were also joined by Miguel Tinker Salas, who's a professor of Latin American history at Pomona College. We'll put a link to all of their information and books at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to everybody who joined us. I apologize that we didn't have enough time to get to everybody. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What's the value of youth mentoring programs? On the Next Year Call, we'll talk to people about their experiences with youth mentorships. Mentors can offer anything from academic encouragement to help dealing with life's challenges. And these relationships have the powerful ability to help people cross social boundaries. If you've been a mentor or a mentee, how did it change you? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What mentoring programs would you recommend to others? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Eric Jansen is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.